Welcome, everybody. Lori McKee, I think you guys all know who I am at this point. We're just going to do a quick roll call. One of the things I wanted to start off by just mentioning is we're going to change a little bit in terms of how we take our minutes. We want to make sure we're capturing everything that's being said, and we always have had an audio tape that can always be referred back to, and we'll keep doing that, but we're going to post that audio tape. So that's a bit of a warning, but also to make sure we're all talking into the microphones. And then our minutes are going to be action items, right? So you're going to be able to see your minutes that show, here are the things we decided to do or agreed to sort of take a next step on or whatever it might be. But also there's the audio record there that people can refer to. So please make sure the light's on when you're speaking. Make sure you're speaking into the microphone. So it's easier for us to keep track of that. And if somebody wants to go back and listen to it, they can actually hear it. All right.
Hello? Okay, working. Okay, so to Lori's left is Savick Ramke from Seneca College, Councillor Parrish from City of Mississauga, Eric Chan from Peel Region, and Lena Bijoni from York Region. And we have Badara Shaman from the Brampton Board of Trade, Stephen Tufts from Brampton, Mississauga and District Labor Council, Shane Raymond from the City of Toronto Resident Representative, David Wojcik, is that right?
Or Smith, okay.
From Mississauga Board of Trade, Anton Norbert from City of Brampton Resident Representative, and we have Hillary Marshall, our VP of Stakeholder Relations and Communications, and Robin Connolly, our Director of Community Relations. And our technical members here today are Paul Steckman from the Ministry of Transportation, Matthew Chu from Ministry of Tourism, and Harold Dremmen from the City of Mississauga.
Great, so we have quorum. Is there anyone else? Oh, and Sean Smith is here, who's from the Council of Unions, and Danny, your last name again. Singh, right, of course. Danny Singh, who works for Councillor Parrish. So thanks very much. I also wanted to introduce Siobhan DeRoche. So Siobhan has been working at the GTA for 2 years now, and she's been in our external communications team. And I'm excited she's moved over in mid-January. She's going to be supporting government relations at municipal and provincial level, so help support this committee as well. So I hope you'll be hearing from her more, and we're excited to have her as part of the team. One of the things I wanted to talk about is, in terms of membership on the committee, we do have a couple of gaps in the membership that I just wanted to raise. There's a letter on your desk that Hillary has sent to Janice at the Toronto Region Board of Trade, because we do have an empty seat for Toronto Region Board of Trade that does need to get filled. That's the only voting member position. Otherwise, the table is full, and we get generally very good attendance, so thank you for that. We do have a number of gaps at the technical team table, and so NAV Canada and the airline industry rep are often not here, so we're going to reach out to those two groups and just make sure that make sure we get somebody here. I think it's important that we do have somebody from NAV Canada and the airlines. Now, I know Bill Devlin from Air Canada did speak to me, and he said, you know, he actually is located in Vancouver, and so for him to come here for a meeting, it's very challenging. So it's probably not the right person for us to have as a member of this committee. So think about whether or not it's an Air Canada person, whether or not we can look at somebody from their National Airlines Council of Canada as a rep on this committee. Open to suggestions and thoughts as well, but I think it's good from an industry, because a lot of the issues we talk about are industry business based, and so it would be good to have an airline voice at the table. And also, we don't have anyone from Transport Canada right now that's attending, so that's a clear gap that we need to fill. So I'll be reaching out to Mike Stevenson, the Regional Director General for Ontario, and make sure we get somebody to come. I sort of joked with somebody just before the meeting started that part of our ground lease requires us to have this committee, and they do the lease monitoring, but so I think it's important that we actually have somebody from transport that comes. And then from Tourism Toronto, we did used to have somebody that came before there was a merger with Mississauga Tourism, and we haven't had anyone lately. So a bit of work to do on the technical side of the membership. Yes, Lena.
Have we thought about the new Toronto Global and getting a representative from them to sit on this committee as well?
That's a really good idea. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the group, it's a merger of Invest Toronto and the former Greater Toronto Marketing Alliance, this Toronto Global, but it's region-based, drawing GTA-based and bringing in investment. And so marketing the region for foreign investment. And so it's something we're very interested in. We think we're a player as an airport in terms of decision making, in terms of companies locating coming here. And I know municipalities that sit around the table here from an economic development perspective have been very engaged. Harold, you and Mississauga have been very engaged in setting up this new organization. I think it was co-chaired by Mayor Tory and Mayor Ryan
of Pickering. Mayor Ryan from the City of Pickering.
So, great idea. Is any objections to reach out to see if we can add them to the table?
Adding them to the technical team or to the whole structure?
I mean, the terms of reference for us, we would have to change.
That's right.
If we actually add another voting member, I think we can add a technical resource non-voting. Without changing the terms of reference, we should reflect it. It doesn't have the same impact.
It doesn't involve a change in the terms of reference. Except that in many cases, double dipping. So you have people who are sitting on their local regional development boards and are also part of the global whole story. So I just want to make sure that it's not giving two voices to one person and that kind of thing.
So why don't we do this way? Why don't we provide for you in between now and the next meeting an overview of the gaps we have at the table and a recommendation about how we propose to fill it and whether it would be a voting or not. And then at our next meeting, if that involves a change to terms of reference, we have a conversation about it at that point. Thank you, Lena. I guess I need to have a motion to approve. A motion to approve our agenda for tonight. So Badar moves it, and Shane, second. All those in favor? Any opposed? That's carried. We also circulated the minutes from our last meeting. They were circulated to everyone. That was from the November 18th meeting, 2016. Any errors, omissions, comments on the minutes before I table the motion?
Members update.
In the minutes. I think we have it. I am.
Sorry, for members update? No.
Oh, it's spelled differently further on. All right, we will correct that before we finalize.
Yeah.
Sorry about that, Badar.
And it feels good that I have it.
Any other errors, omissions, changes? Right, a motion to approve the minutes from November the 18th, 2016. Davik, were you at the meeting?
Oh, no, I can't.
You can't do that. Somebody was at the meeting. All right, Jar. A seconder. Lena, you were there.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. All those in favor?
I forgot, but I was there.
Thank you. So long time. All right, there's coffee at the back of the room. All right. We don't have any action items approved or arising from the previous minutes, and so just move along to our regular updates. One of the things I thought we should just take a minute to recast back and look at last year. So we met four times last year, March, June, September, and November. Remember at the beginning of the year, at the very first meeting, we had done a survey to talk to committee members about the issues that you wanted to see us talk about throughout the year. And so one of my questions is, should we do that again? So just to recap, there was a strong interest in talking about transit. There was an interest in talking about labor issues, regional airports, economic development issues, So at our first meeting of the year, we did talk about the transit center. At the time, we were talking about it as a mobility hub, and a member of Robin Connolly's team who's here came and talked about our community investment program. At our second meeting in June, we shared results from an economic impact study. If you remember, we were over at the terminal, and we had one of my colleagues come in and talk about the 150 days of summer, and then we went through the IOCC and also had a presentation on some of the passenger flow issues that we were focused on largely with federal government. In September, there was a presentation on regional airports, and we had a guest speaker come in from Woodbine to talk about their redevelopment plans. It was Jessica Buckley. And Kathy Weiss from Durham did a presentation on their economic development planning and strategic board. And then our last meeting of the year, we had Pamela Blaze come in. She's a consultant that does work with the NEPTIS Foundation to talk about the work that they've done on the employment zone around the airport. And again, we did a deeper dive into the regional benefits that were identified in our economic impact work. So we covered a lot of the issues that we had said we wanted to talk about. So it might be time to think about doing the survey again to make sure if there's issues people want to talk about. One of the items we did not talk about last year, but it's on our agenda today to talk about, is labor issues. So Robin's here to give us a presentation today on that. So thoughts about whether or not we do another survey to think about the issues? We did it as a doodle poll. Any objection to doing that? Okay, so we'll structure something to send it back out and make sure we're capturing the things you want to talk about. We always do our update to you. So in the regular update to the committee, we talk about the mega hub strategy that we're pursuing, and there was a paper that was released in December. We're also going to have a presentation today by Hillary Marshall on that. Regular stats on our operations, we continue to see significant growth, 6-7% year over year. That's adding 3 million more passengers every year. Airplane movements are not growing at the same rate as passenger movements, but just adding those number of people every year to the terminal building is creating constraints to manage. And so we keep working very closely with CASA and CBSA on that. And transit's the other big challenge we have in terms of moving those number of people. We always want to give a look to you of what's happening from a noise perspective as well. That's one of the terms of reference links back to CNAC, which is the Community Environment Noise Advisory Committee that Robin chairs, to make sure that you have a good sight line. We have lots of strong economic benefits from an airport, and our role as an economic enabler for the economy, but we know that we also have impacts in terms of what we do, so we need to be vigilant on how we manage those. So you can see from a complaint perspective across the regions what the numbers were for for all of last year. Any questions on the update? Pretty standard stuff. If there's issues you want to hear us talking more about in the updates, one of the other things that we did last year that I want to make sure you're seeing, and we'll send them out. We've got a federal budget coming up, and we have a provincial budget coming up. So we did put in submissions that we won't kill any more trees and share paper, but we'll circulate those with the minutes so you see those. And we also put in a submission to the Places to Grow update that the province is doing right now, and that will feed into an update to the Big Move. And from a transit planning perspective, one of our concerns is that work that Pamela talked to us about that identified this employment zone around the airport, the foundational planning documents that the province uses, the Places to Grow, doesn't recognize those employment nodes. It recognizes urban growth centers, and then planning identifies those urban growth zones, but really hasn't captured where a lot of growth actually is occurring, which is in these. So we've got a recommendation that we'd like the province to pick up on, and we understand that's pretty active right now in conversations at the provincial level. So we will share those with you as well, so you have those. That is the end of the updates I have. Any other updates at this point? We always do our go-around at the end as well for committee member updates, but anything else people wanted to add before we go into our presentations? Silence, all right. So our first presentation is from Robin Connolly. Robin is our Director of Community Relations at Toronto Pearson, and so I think, Siobhan, we're going to have to move out of the way.
Let me just go to Councillor. Hi, good afternoon. I'm here to share with you an approach that we have developed in collaboration with labor representatives here at the airport to undertake some work and some research as a first phase to better understand the makeup of the Toronto Pearson workforce. So this is a chance to update on that. And I'll just add, Stephen, since we have had the chance to work on this collaboratively, if there's anything you want to add or I'm misrepresenting, please speak up. And Sean, too. Sean doesn't have a mic, so that might be good or bad. I don't know. Great. So, could be me, honestly. Starting with some context. So, as there's very much the mandate of this committee, as you know, the airport drives incredible economic impacts and benefits well beyond our doors. And we are a huge employment generator right now. Actually, since 2011, when the total number of jobs for airport-wide was at 40,000, it's now reached up to 49,000, which is quite incredible growth. And that's jobs in and at the airport, so from the GTAA to retail, concessions, ground handlers, airlines, but then 332,000 jobs facilitated because of the airport. And as you heard at the last, when NEPTIS was here at the last meeting, that effectively means the airport represents the second largest employment zone in the country, which is actually, when you think about it, really, really remarkable and the depth and diversity of the different roles here. And as we look at the growth that's coming, and Hillary will touch on that in her presentation, but with that growth and passenger growth in at the airport, so too will then the jobs also continue to grow and anticipate out on a horizon of to 2030, about 700,000 jobs in the airport area. So that's quite a lot, and probably 60,000 jobs here alone at the airport. So that's quite unprecedented growth, and also probably then represents the right time to try to understand that workforce makeup a little bit better. And we know that understanding that is also really essential to making sure that the airport grows sustainably and that we are committed on delivering on our commitments to being a good neighbor. Obviously, so this growth leads to increased employment opportunities, but we need to make sure that the appropriate talent pipelines are being developed. We need to make sure it remains a great place to work and drive the campaigns that connect the employees here at the airport and make sure that they're being respected and maintained. And of course, I don't know if we got into this detail last year when we were here talking about our community investment program. It was probably still under development, but we are really, when we understood better that we are sort of that second largest employment zone in the country, we understood that that also represented a really, really interesting opportunity to have a better, greater impact and make those ties stronger to the communities around the airport who are some of the most underserved in the country and explore ways to bring some of those employment opportunities to them, to here. So we have to make sure, we have to understand that piece and make sure that we are building good pathways to good employment and that delivers on that important initiative for the airport as well. But understanding the workforce is once you sort of get to it, it becomes an incredibly complex issue, and there's three major complexities driving that. When we say 49,000 jobs here at the airport, that's jobs under about 300 employers here at the airport. So there's an incredible diversity in the number of employers and the roles that people are playing. And then there's different layers and conditions between all those different employment relationships. There's also a very complicated legislative framework. Some operate under provincial statutes and some operate under federal statutes. So that makes a sort of a complicated layer of being able to understand the workforce. And there's fundamentally a lack of data. We have a lot of anecdotal stories. One of the only things that we have is everybody who works here has to have a purple rake. And so we have some information based on that, namely maybe where people's postal code is and maybe their gender. But beyond that, we don't have much other information. So there's a big gap in data and understanding the workforce. And so I'm in collaboration with the Airport Council of Unions, which is a council made up of the 5 or 6 main unions here at the airport who meet on a regular basis. And we developed we've been working on for a couple of years now, actually, a 3-phase study to better understand these complexities and start to get a handle on that data. Because going forward and looking forward at this growth, we want to make database decisions, and evidence-based decisions, not decision-based evidence. That is a term from Stephen. So phase one of this work is, this is sort of when we talk about the complexities of the workforce composition, this is sort of a slide that represents that. Is that a bit fuzzy or are my glasses really bad?
Fuzzy.
Okay, yes. Okay, good. Well, which is maybe not great for everyone, but anyway, at least I'm not losing my sight. So there are the different layers of the workforce. There's the government agencies, obviously. Then there's the GTAA. And then there's services that are contracted to the GTAA that are our contractors. Then there's tenants here who have a license to operate from us. And then there's the tenant contractors as well who are contracted out by the tenants, but who also, though, have to get a license to operate from us. So that's an incredibly complex and diverse composition. And so there's a lot of nuances to all those relationships. And we don't necessarily have an understanding whether the terms of all the contracts and license to operate are similar across all the employers at the airport. So phase one of the work that we are working on to sort of get a better grasp on the employment makeup and the data is an airport benchmark study and an environmental scan. And this is really just to understand how both workforce composition, contracting, and labor issues are managed by other comparable airports. And again, so this is to sort of review with airports with a similar governance structure, complexity of operations, and projected growth to understand how they manage their workforce composition, what is their contract management policies, what are some of their mitigation and management issues to deal with workforce issues, how are they undertaking workforce planning, and the whole intent is to sort of benchmark GTA's own practices to understand how they compare and whether there are things that we should be considering adopting either at the GTAA or working with our airport colleagues and the co-employers to explore. So we are working with a professional services consultant, KPMG, actually, to undertake this work. Seemed all very foreign to me, but it was great. They've actually just finished a similar study, they told me, for the airport of Copenhagen. So that also speaks to that this is something that airports are working and grappling with. We're not alone. And so we are in the process of scoping out that work, and that should be complete shortly. We will go back to the Airport Council of Unions and make sure that the scope of work also addresses what they were expecting from this study. And then we'll begin the work, which will be largely research-based. So that'll be a good fundamental. Again, we can't be alone in these issues, and so this is just a really good chance to benchmark where we're at and understand what's going on in this sphere. So the next phase of this work, though, is an airport workforce demographic study. This is where things, I think, will really get really interesting, and this is a chance to produce a demographic profile of the current workforce at Toronto Pearson to understand the current wage and skills profiles of the airport employees, amongst other things. There is a really interesting opportunity to understand where they're coming from, what are their transit and commuting patterns. Some of the data that we don't have is how many people really are or aren't making above a living wage, and also how many people are performing more than one job at the airport. We have a lot of anecdotes about some of these challenges, but we don't necessarily have the data behind it. So this is a good opportunity to understand the makeup of our current workforce. We'll do that through census data. The timing of this is great, actually, that we can now go and use the 2016 data, which will be quite rich. And that's beginning to get rolled out in its more drilled down fashion. So that'll be a great source for us. And also survey work as well. We'll complement that with some survey work and go out and put some boots on the ground and talk to employees working at the different across the airport and all the different roles to sort of get this fulsome picture. And a big piece of this is that this will help us understand the current profile and then begin to help us understand the gaps. And then in the labor market supply, as we start to look at that, developing that talent pipeline and what the airport needs to look like when it's, you know, delivering on 60 million passengers a year. Which then, of course, brings us to phase three, which is then taking all this data that we've come to understand and developing a future labor market needs study. So again, this is identifying emerging skills and gaps and recommending the policies and programming to address these gaps. So that'll sort of be, you know, down the line, but that'll also start to make sure that we're set up to be building out a sustainable and responsive workforce for a mega hub airport and a major economic driver and employer for the Southern Ontario region. In terms of governance and timing, as I mentioned, phase one will be led by a professional services firm and we'll have oversight from a cross-functional, cross-departmental GTA steering committee, but with input from the Airport Council of Unions. And phase two and phase three, we will work out to a third-party consultant, whether that's a professional services firm or a university, or there are some organizations that do specifically this work. We're starting to try to understand the lay of that land now. And it will be subject to oversight of a joint industry, labor, government, and academic steering committee. We think this will be incredibly a really data-rich exercise, and having great oversight from all those different stakeholders will help make sure it's fulsome and addressing some of the issues and a cutting edge study as well. In terms of timing, the work on the benchmarking study and the scoping has started and we do expect to have that back by Q3 2017. If all goes according to plan, and how often does that happen, but it should be done by May. And then we'll start to scope out and get into the workforce demographic study and the future labor market needs study. We sort of expect all this work will take about 18 months. So it'll be over the next couple of years. So that's just an overview of where we think we're headed. But I'm sure there's a lot of nodding heads here. So I feel like this is the kind of issues and studies that aren't new to this table. So, yeah, we would really appreciate your questions and feedback and suggestions and advice as we start to build this out. Or Stephen, I don't know if you have anything you wanted to add.
I can go afterwards. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask Stephen, through you, is there a way of streamlining the licensing and the employees having to, you mentioned there that big shop owner or retailer then contracts to somebody else who then hires staff, but everybody requires licensing. Is there a way to streamline that so that the employees that are working, that are contracted to work for these retailers are protected?
I'll just jump in one second. Like, there are some airports that have streamlined the number of suppliers. So, for example, Vancouver streamlined the number of in-flight catering service providers. Yeah. And they are under review. That process is now under review by the Competition Bureau of Canada. So, for anti-competitive. So we want to be careful, but we also want to understand what other airports are doing.
This is the whole point of the first study, right?
Do you want to add anything to that, Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, two things, but this report is going through, which a lot of airports have gone through, Chicago, is institutional upgrading of its ancillary services. So you see, it started with L.A. If you've been to the L.A. airport, you know Wolfgang Puck has a restaurant, and that replaces some of the fast food outlets, and I think that's the case or the plan for Terminal 3 as well, to upgrade the food services. So you're going to have suppliers and tenants change over time as part of that process, and some of that's inevitable. I think the real issue is streamlining is the rakes itself, is how can you increase the speed of which security clearances are given to employees. And if you reduce turnover by giving higher wages, you don't have to have as many security clearances, and we're hoping that over time that can be achieved. But also, and related to that with the demographic study, I really do think that there's a lot of rich data there from the security clearance data that, if it can be accessed, would give a very detailed demographic profile of where workers, how tenure in Canada, age, gender, place of live, and they've done that with the transit study. The survey captured some of that, right, which is very interesting. So I think once of all this data is brought together, we're going to get a very interesting story about workers at the airport, and will allow us to, in an evidentiary-based way, head off what could be in the future and what's happening in the U.S. We start what happens when there's a travel ban? What happens when there's a reduced immigration? What is it? What would it mean for a workforce that is primarily immigrant, right? And so I think this is why we have to think these studies long term and what their political power can be, and why we have to be proactive now and not wait until a Kelly Leach or a Kevin O'Leary get into power.
I think a big piece in the first study as well is understanding the different governance structures that the airports operate under, mm-hmm. and what that does and does make not make feasible is it will be a big component as well.
Any person on the street that goes to the airport, we, and I'm saying myself included, think that everybody that works there works under one employer.
Yeah.
The airport.
Yeah.
And that's what people think.
Well, you know, if it was easy, we probably would come up with a solution already, but that's what makes all of it so interesting, the complexity of the workforce. I don't want to miss out on Sean. Sean, is there anything you want to say on this point?
Yes, thanks for the opportunity, Hillary. We're very happy about this because this is a long time, as Robin said, coming. Because there's a lot of, the airport is fueled by rumors and caffeine. Everyone thinks
rumors and
caffeine.
Oh, okay.
Everyone thinks that someone else has a better deal or a worse deal than them because there's so many employers. It's, as Hillary says, it's a city. It's a complex place. And this is the first chance for us to actually see what is the real story, as opposed to having many of our discussions right now are all hypothetical, or we on the labor side think it's the worst we've ever seen versus employers saying it's the best they've ever seen. And we need the facts in order to actually start making progress for the future, because this is no longer a small airport. This is now becoming a worldwide hub that we need to grow. But and that's why we're so happy to see the third phase, because that's the important phase, is we need to be positioned so that we don't have the labor issues of the current or the past impede this future growth. So that's why we're very pleased about this, and we just ask that it be consultative throughout, because as long as the players are feeling they're part of it, then the answers might not be answers we all like, but at least if we have the actual facts, it makes it much easier then for us to move forward. So we're very thankful for this.
Do tenants of the airport or parties operating under license have any minimum standards for labor, like as part of their contract to work at the airport or carry on a business there?
I think that the point of this study is to begin to understand that.
Well, I mean, like, for example, with me, office is in a building owned by Cadillac Fairview. If I want to carry out any repairs in that building, it has to be through unionized work. Whether I like it or not, it's just a term of being a tenant. I would imagine the airport, should it choose, it probably doesn't want to get too onerous or it becomes micromanagement. But I bet they already have certain terms. Like, I'd imagine a term is that you can only hire employees with certain security clearance. So I just wonder what is imposed at this point, and is there a desire for the airport to maybe look into imposing additional terms on employment practices for its tenants?
I think that's something that will come up because, you know, there's the companies that we contract directly, and so they've gone through a competitive bidding process for the most part. And then there's others that have what's called the license to operate, either because they're a subcontractor. And so one of the questions to be asked is, are they all the same? What can you do? You know, not to step or toe into something that Vancouver's done, but look at that. So that's part of what the analysis would look at.
There's a cost every time you impose anything on a contracting party. Like what I was saying with me having to use unionized employers, or like for works, we pay less rent because it's a Cadillac Fairview building for that reason. So you don't want to impose too much, but there might be certain minimum requirements that really make sense in accordance with the airport's policy.
And that condition to have security clearance and a rate to work here, is that's an easy one.
don't think we could get around that.
Can't get away with that, and yes, it does take a long time to get them, and it's something getting slower.
Okay, a couple of things from the airline side of it. They do subcontract out certain work where it's controlled, but they don't have to have rakes and things of that nature. You're looking at minimum wage jobs, okay? Third-party companies that do baggage handling, as an example, and I've seen three or four change at the airport over the last 20 years. They're minimum wage jobs. I think the GTAA took over de-icing about 2 years ago, correct? Because the service levels were poor, and they wanted to create a standard, and obviously that has come at a cost because the wages of those individuals associated with the GTAA are higher, but the industry will pay for it, right? Everything you add to the cost of travel is going to be passed on to the passenger. So you got to be really careful how you go around those things. But there, you know, a living wage in Toronto, I just saw an article a few days ago, the cost of housing, or rent and these types of things are going to drive $15 an hour is not going to cut it. Okay. So, there's two jobs, that type of stuff. It's quite a common thing. You can't mandate, I don't think you can mandate, a standard wage, for a city. I know they've done it in New York and places like that, right? But.
No, you couldn't, but as you could impose through contract on, I'm not suggesting that it's a prudent step.
Yeah, and you know, I see young kids, some of my young kids will start off with a job like that and eventually move in. I said, just start somewhere. Just get some experience, get a feel for what you're doing. Make sure you work safe in that sense, right? Because there are a lot of risks involved in working on certain jobs. But, that's what the industry's paid for years. And if you look at the security risk of a low wage individual and these types of things, and I don't want to brand anybody, in any which way, but there are risks involved based on, what you earn. So it brings a whole bunch of things into the challenge, right? So
as a traveler, I don't mind paying more to avoid turnover with someone de-icing my airplane.
The funny thing is
pretty good money well spent.
I always ask the kids if a plane crashed somewhere and this airline was really bad, but you can get a $1.99 ticket down to Mexico, would you go? And they go, yeah, I'm taking a risk, right?
But so
it's people.
I mean, I don't think we can only think in ways that higher wages automatically leads to higher costs in every instance. There's so many things that go into the price of an airline ticket, such as fuel surcharges, such as taxes, that I think we all have to consider. Secondly, that we can't assume that there isn't any flexibility in the system and the revenue base in the airports that can't be shifted around to wages. 13 cents of every buck that the GTA earns has to be kicked up to the federal government. That's something that's negotiable over time. And I think that's the second thing. Third thing is it's also a cost to not increasing wages for some of these jobs. The turnover, the lack of productivity, the training costs. In many cases, this is a wash. So I don't know if we can start automatically assuming that every time somebody gets a 50 cent an hour raise, that the price of air tickets are going to radically increase. And I also don't buy the idea that just because it hasn't been done a lot in Canada that it can't be done with the local regulation of wages. There are ways of getting around it. It has been done. City of Toronto has it. The construction sector has it. Where you can say, you can put so many demands on people if they want to work in your, or do a contract on the facility. Why can't just one more be $15 every employee minimum wage? I don't see how that, just because it hasn't been done before, I don't know if it means it can't be done.
Look at the security changes over the years at the airport, where CATSA looks after previously was private companies, and the standards have changed completely. That comes at a cost, obviously.
Sean has something he wants to say here.
Just very quickly, the reason we push for the second study is, to your point exactly, we don't know how many, what the wages, like, as I said, everything's fueled by rumor. There's a lot of these 50,000 jobs that are very well-paying jobs. There's no pilots talking minimum wage. And that's why we're pushing that second study. And that's why I said we need the facts, because what are we talking about? We might be spending a lot of energy talking about a few groups, a small group of workers or a large group. And that's why we need to first see what is the impact of this. And that's why the second study is there, is for the demographics.
I think it's also interesting to note that the province is considering minimum wage and living wage. And so whether or not, and you're hearing this discussed more broadly across the country. It also remains to be seen what action will be taken on that front at the provincial level. This may feed into that work as well.
So I think it's clear that there's an interest in this committee being kept up to date on this issue. So, Robin, I think we're going to tap you on the shoulder to come in and at milestone points. And given we meet four times a year, it's probably going to be at each meeting we'll get an update of where you're at on the study.
When will a report like that become public?
Maybe the question should be, will it become public?
I think it already is, isn't it? I think it's pretty public already. So, I think, again, the first one we expect to have done by Q3, which is that benchmarking piece to sort of begin to start to understand what other airports are doing. And actually, to the point down here, KPMG has recommended we also consider looking at property developers and or hospitals, like company organizations that sort of have this complexity of being an owner and operator with many tenants in it, to see if there's things there to learn in terms of best practices. The demographic stuff, I mean, I think we expect it to take 18 months. We know it's really complicated. We know it's complicated, and especially since it's new to us, it's probably extra complicated. So we expect sort of in the next 18 months, 2 years to sort of.
So we have a meeting in May, and I don't know if there's going to be much new by then, but definitely by the October 4th meeting, it would be great to have you come back. And
absolutely.
Maybe at that point you'll have
sure. At least. Might be. The first one should be done by May, though, too.
Oh, I thought it was Q3.
Well, I thought it's, yeah, it could be done by May. So anyway, we'll figure it out.
We can talk about that.
You know how to find me.
Yep, I know we are.
I know how to find you.
Excellent. Thank you. So our next item on the agenda is Hillary Marshall. So Hillary is our Vice President of Stakeholder Relations and Communications, and she's going to talk to you more about the Mega Hub vision for the airport. Behind you is a board that, Hillary, you can reference at Liberty in terms of the transit center that was unveiled. There's a number of slides at the beginning you may want to go through quickly, because I think Robin stole your thunder on a few. But
I know.
Robin mowed my grass again. So all of you are important partners. It's likely that you've heard about the incredible growth that's happening here at Pearson in one form or another, or one time or another. But you may not have heard us start to talk about this new type of airport, a mega hub airport. And that's only really been a narrative that we've started to share over the last 3 months, I'd say, 3 to 6 months. And that's because we're really seeing a new type of growth at the airport, a new trend in our growth. And I want to talk to you about it today and what it means for the airport, but more importantly, what it means for the region. Now, all of you are familiar. We're already the largest airport in the country, more than twice the size of any other airport. For the last 20 years, the airport's been operated as a not-for-profit, but it is a private corporation. And we do not receive any subsidies to fund our operations. So we're a user fee model. So as people are talking more and more about user pay, and how to support infrastructure, here we are. We're a great example of how it works. In terms of our growth story, no secret, you've probably seen this slide before. We're really experiencing this doubling of traffic every 20 years or so, and we forecast that that's going to continue. Here's our year-over-year passenger and movement growth. So you can see that from 2014 to 2015, we crossed over that 40 million threshold mark in terms of our passengers. And that is, we're getting up into the biggest category of airports, international airports in particular, and that's consistent with the growth that we've seen in 2016 as well, and we'll be reporting those results towards the 22nd, I believe it is, of the month. So what does that mean today? In terms of what's going on here at Pearson, we're really able to connect passengers to 67% of the world's economies through daily nonstop flights. So quite often, you know, if you went into Expedia and you typed in where you want to go, you might come up with options for flights. One stop, two stop, Lord help you, you might even come up with three or four stops. But the beauty of having an international airport like Pearson is that you can get those direct nonstop flights, not only important for passengers, but also for cargo. A lot of cargo is moving through Pearson now. And we're talking about 180 destinations we can take you through today. You saw this from Robin, important source of jobs, both here directly at the airport and across the region. And we're very, very proud of the fact that we've become the second largest international passenger airport in terms of international passengers. So there are lots of airports in North America. One of the largest is the airport in Atlanta. I think it's got about 100 million passengers. The number, the percentage of passengers who are traveling internationally from that airport is very small. It's 10% or less. So when you contemplate that Pearson, JFK, these are airports with significant amounts of international and connecting passenger traffic, that's really what makes us special. We're also moving a lot of goods. You've probably heard the lobster story before about $80 million worth of lobsters being exported, half of it, or $39 million, which is coming through Pearson. So why is that important? You take, and it's not just important for this region, it's important for the entire country. You take lobster coming out of Halifax, it comes on a flight to Pearson, it gets on a direct nonstop flight to Beijing. A growing appetite for products like fresh lobster in emerging economies means that this is just one example of how an international airport with those daily nonstop flights is really facilitating trade, tourism, and passengers. Of course, we're an economic catalyst. We've done the research with Frontier Economics, and we believe we facilitate about 6.3% of the province's GDP. So, mega hubs. What are these mega hub airports? Well, we know that they exist in different jurisdictions around the world. These are typically airports that are more than 50 million passengers and have more than 20 million of their passengers who are international. Okay, these are the biggest top-tier airports around the world. They control routes, they have the most destinations, they have the most carriers, and they create significant economic benefits for the countries they're located in, the regions they're located in, and we believe that they'll just continue to grow as these massive pipes for international connectivity. So, you know, why should we be a mega hub? Well, like I said, global competitiveness. We believe a mega hub airport has connectivity to 80% of the world's global economy. So right now we're at 67%. We want to see the opportunities created by being connected to that many trading partners, that many tourism partners, lifted through this mega hub opportunity. Job opportunities as well. So 700,000 jobs could potentially be facilitated by having a mega hub airport and, you know, increasing the percentage of GDP facilitation to 8.5%. So then the question becomes, well, how do we get to this golden place that we all want to go to? And we've taken a look at what factors contribute to these airports becoming mega hubs, and how can we support that here at Pearson, and what should we be talking to different levels of government and our stakeholders about? Well, number one, so inside the airport, there are things that we want to address, and then outside the airport. And these are all about moving the passengers, moving the cargo, moving the workers at the airport so that we can be as efficient and effective as possible. So number one will make sense. It's really building that regional transit network. So being a global gateway is important, but more importantly, connecting the trade, the tourism, the cargo through to other points in the region, as well as getting people moving to and from this important employment zone, very important. So to that extent, and I'm going to talk about it in more detail, we have a vision for really connecting Pearson to transit throughout the region. Shorter wait times. So 2, 3, and 4, or 2, 3 in particular, are really about how we move people within the airport itself. And some of these will be familiar to you. So passenger, no secret. If you've had an experience at traveling through an airport, connecting through an airport, and you've had to wait a considerable amount of time, whether it's for CATS, security screening, to get through customs, it might color how you think about that airport and whether or not you're going to choose that airport to use in the future for your connecting flight. And so we want to make sure we're addressing that. International passenger supportive policies. So we want to make sure that we're best in class with other top-tier airports when it comes to visa requirements. And again, this comes down to your ability to seamlessly move through the airport as quickly as possible. And of course, airports can't grow just because they want to grow. They have to grow with support from the communities that they operate in and have trust from those communities. And so in order to do that, we know that growing responsibly and sustainably is an important part of what how we build that trust. Back to the first point on this regional transit network. Building this transit network, I mean, you heard from Robin, this is the second largest employment zone after downtown Toronto. NEPTIS did research on this employment zone. They looked at the number of jobs, the key areas within the employment zone where there are the most jobs. There's the opportunity for increased density, particularly in that Mississauga Airport Corporate Center. And the biggest challenge is connecting these areas to transit. So there are over 1 million car trips daily to the area in this circle. And that's probably not a surprise. I mean, you folks come out here, you know that the airport, the highways ringing the airport can get quite congested. There aren't the transit options necessarily that you would want that give you the good options to get here. And that's the same for workers. That's the same for passengers. We did research just in 2016 and on public opinion. And the number two issue after security concerns with the security screening and the wait times at the airport would be transit connectivity. Really interesting because that's unprompted, right? So people are telling us that they want better options to get to the airport. We also have done, as we've started to look out at our long-term growth, so, you know, 25 to 30 years out, we know that air traffic is set to double. It's set to double globally. And that as well will be consistent here in North America and for the Southern Ontario as well. We'll get up to 90 million plus passengers, we expect. So that means that, what's that?
Too stressful.
Well, so we know that, you know, we've talked before about working together with the other airports in the region to manage the growth and to make sure that we're all acting as a voluntary system of airports. One of the other things we looked at was the increased travel time to and from the airport to key points in the region. And we're seeing Stephen Miller, Professor Stephen Miller at U of T did this work for us and found that there'll be a 25 to 35% increase in driving time by 2043. So I'm going to be listening to a lot more books as I commute back and forth, or I'll be on transit, more importantly. So we know we want to do something about this. And when we know we're not the only airport grappling with this, so we looked at airports around the world, and Pearson has less than 10% of passengers and workers taking workers. You know, when you combine the two, less than 10% are taking transit. Compared to some of these other airports, gosh, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Amsterdam, London Heathrow, even Vancouver has a much higher mode split than we do. So we're targeting getting to 30% mode split over the 30-year period. And in order to do that, we have looked at the transit lines that could connect to Pearson, and I'm going to show you that in a second, but we've also started to think about the growth that we'll need to take. Given the growth that's coming, what we're going to need to do to manage that growth, and what we've done is to consider what it would look like if we put a processing center, so the area where passengers arrive, check in, go through security screening, and if we move that to the north side of Dixon Road and combine that with a transit center, kind of like a Union Station West, how that would enable us to change the terminal structure. Of course, it would be secure on that north end of the circle. You'll see the two terminals. You know, this is very conceptual. Don't hold us to this exact rendering. It's going to change with, and I'm sure there will be significant input from our carrier partners about this vision. But really what we see here is that we can bring in many transit lines, and that we can combine this kind of transit center with a processing facility and really focus on improving the sense of place, and whether it's, you know, sidewalks, lighting, landscaping, we can do more to make this airport area a better place to work and I won't say live. So that is the transit center. One more point I want to make on the transit / processing center is that we have told our stakeholders, and we envision funding this transit center as part of our processing center through our own means. So we are not looking to any level of government to support us with the development of this project. So I mentioned that we'd started to look at, you know, as part of our goal to address the mode split, we had to look at what transit lines are coming into the airport, and I'm going to try to use the red dot. Sorry, Ingrid.
Okay.
You don't let me touch the technology. You should see my phone. It's been dropped many times. Cool. I'm ready to go. I'm enabled. Okay, so you can see what comes into Pearson in terms of higher order transit. It's the Union Pearson Express. We do have some very popular routes, including the 192 Airport Rocket. We have the Lawrence bus route that comes in. That is, what number is that, 52? 192. Oh, so the Rocket is the wrong one. Okay. And we also have the Mississauga Transitway. But when we look at what's envisioned for the region, what various municipalities are talking about, as well as the province, then we start to ask ourselves, well, what's the potential to connect Pearson in a transit center into these various lines? So Eglinton LRT and Finch LRT are both being carried by, being discussed at the City of Toronto and are moving forward as part of their vision for at least the Eglinton LRT west from Mount Dennis over and up. This is Renforth Gateway coming up into the transit center. That's moving forward with studies. We envision potentially connecting Finch LRT down into the transit center. Here, we have the Mississauga Bus Rapid Transit coming up into Renforth Gateway. We've been sitting at a table with city staff, City of Mississauga staff, as well as City of Toronto and Metrolinx team members to talk about the potential for a bridge to bring them both over into the transit center. At a provincial level, you have the RER line that comes up, as well as the high-speed rail line that's being studied by David Collinette. We understand a report has been submitted to the province, and we're looking forward to hearing the details of that report and whether or not that could come into Pearson as well. So lots of different lines, lots of discussions, lots of priorities. Obviously, there are many competing priorities, a lot of pressure being put on all levels of government to support and fund infrastructure. We've had good support. I won't say that anybody's written checks, and I won't hold you to that either, Carolyn. But good enough. Come next time. Come next time with your checkbook. But at the same time, many of our mayors, our local mayors, have identified connecting to Pearson as a priority. In fact, Minister Del Duca just today during his speech at the Mississauga Board of Trade, David, excellent speech, excellent event, talked about how connecting transit into Pearson is a priority, and they want to do more on that. So, you could see that here. Here's exactly what he said. There's a lot happening, and there's a lot more to do, including better connections to Toronto Pearson. So we're very proud to have this alignment. We think there is considerable alignment between the municipal, provincial, and federal levels of government in terms of understanding the potential to connect Pearson to transit and potentially setting a table where all, because we sit in between Mississauga and Toronto, of course we are Mississauga's international airport, everybody knows that, how we can get on with this. Of course, it's not just about Pearson and its needs. It's about getting people through the region to different points in the region more easily. It's about reducing congestion. We think that as Pearson continues to grow over that 25 to 30 year period, we can help to reduce emissions from automobile traffic by about 10% compared to what they would have been if nothing was done. And we also know that, as Robin said, there are many communities that surround the airport area, whether it's Rexdale, Malton, Mount Dennis, Weston, go on, where they are priority neighborhoods and transit equality gives them access to jobs. And so we think that on that level, this is equally important. Talked about shorter wait times for passengers and getting passengers through as quickly as possible. Lori, you just give me an eyeball if I'm going on too long. So when you look around the world at other airports, these top-tier airports, they're screening passengers much faster than we are currently in Canada. And you can see what Pearson's stats are compared to Hong Kong or London Heathrow. And since we're not competing with other Canadian airports, we are competing with big hubs like these, as well as JFK and LAX, for these international and connecting passengers. It's very important that we get these screening standards right. Same with the borders. So we want very much to work with our partners in customs and public safety to make sure that there's standards set for how quickly you can get through customs as well, so 90% in 20 minutes. Of course, for each of those, there are policy considerations, there's funding considerations, so that's why it's taking some time to move through the system. I talked about visas, but this is equally important. So airports growing revenue from other sources than the passenger, the carriers. This is a third source, this non-aeronautical revenue, and the more we can increase this as a source of our revenue, the more it enables us to bring down other costs and charges within the airport. Other airports around the world are really focused on this. Some of the ways that we think we can do this beyond the degree to which we do it today, and we're up above 30% of our total revenue is generated from non-aeronautical revenue. We'd like to get even higher, and some of the things that we think we can do would be to arrivals duty-free and dual duty-free put in place. We know we need to work with various levels of government to do that. And there's benefits. There's benefits to the province in the form of provincial income tax and corporate income taxes as well, and for the LCBO as well. I'm going to flip through this. Like I said, we can't grow unless we build trust-based relationships with the communities around us. And so these are just two of the ways that we know we have to invest and understand the impact of the airport. One would be noise management, and this is about continuous improvement in the impact of our operations as we continue to grow, looking at best practices, working with the other partners in the aviation space, whether it's NAV Canada, the carriers, to see if we can adapt our operations to quieter protocols that have less impact on communities. As well, on the environment side, the number of workers here at Pearson did shoot up last year. We have more than 1 million bees working here now. We're going to put them in the demographic study. Stephen, with your permission.
They're not called worker bees for no reason at all.
Yeah, true. And then, sorry, and obviously, I don't know that we have a slide here on the community investment program. I know Robin has come to speak to you about it before, but getting out into the community and engaging through public consultation, open houses. We are having a fair number of open houses, and we like to partner with representatives at various levels of government to host those and to talk to people about the jobs, the environmental sustainability initiatives, our operations, the growth, noise management. These people are just fascinated by what goes on here at the airport. And so having these open houses and showing up in their communities at their events really does kind of demystify the airport for them. Being an active community member is important to the entire organization and our partners, of course. Many of our partners have community investment programs, very robust at the carriers specifically. But here at Pearson in 2016, our board really and our management team really understood the need to really invest in the community in a way that has meaningful impact. And so we did a lot of research. We talked to a lot of our stakeholders. And the area, I mean, Robin should really be speaking about this, but the area that we decided would have the most impact and addresses what goes on here at the airport most significantly. Pearson continues to grow and creates all these opportunities for the region and the country. Doesn't it make sense that some of the communities closest to the airport that are priority neighborhoods that can use more support in terms of skills development and access to jobs be supported? And so Robin and her team have done an amazing amount of work to create this vision and to start to talk to community partners about how they can access funding for these programs. So some of the initiatives that we've started to fund would include scientists in the schools. It would include innovation labs in Brampton, co-op programs that they have there. What else have we got?
Civic Action
is doing a study on youth employment, barriers to youth employment. So there's many ways that this program is really starting to shape, and I think it will, we hope that over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll address some of those gaps in terms of the access to employment and skills within the local neighborhoods. So, we're not just the region's airport, we're the country's airport. I think that whether it's connecting tourism to different parts of the country, moving workers, cargo through to other points in the country. We understand the very large and significant role we play and the economic impact we have from coast to coast. We believe that if we can secure these benefits, the benefits of a mega hub for this region and for the entire country, it's the right thing to do. We know that there are things that we need to consider very carefully in terms of how we grow sustainably. And would love to hear your perspectives on the vision and how we get there.
Thank you very much, Lori.
Thank you.
First question, Councillor Parrish.
Well, I don't actually have a question. I have a couple of comments, given that I'm the councillor for Malton. First of all, I want to thank the GTAA for a lot of the things you're doing to make life easier for us in Malton. You've been very cooperative. You are doing partnerships with us on events that are fun events that Malton people are starting to come out to. The most important thing you've done is worked with the city staff to relax some of the objections on infill housing, because we don't have any lots. We don't have anything left to build in Malton, and people want to work at the airport and live close by. So we're doing a bit of a rejuvenation of what's in there, and you've relaxed some of the objections on the noise problems. Our noise problems are more from trucks. We have 19,000 trucks a day going through three major roads, Goreway, Derry, an airport road. So that is the ambient noise that drowns your planes right out. So I think once you figured that out, you said, okay, that's all right, then we're not going to object to this, this, and this location. So I want to thank you for that. Watching this, I guess I have to be careful if we're being recorded. You had four quotes from politicians. That's not what they say when they're at their councils. They talk about, yeah, you guys go ahead. And I think you got a bad reaction from the Mississauga Council when it came to us. Because it was in the newspapers and nobody had told us how you're going to do the funding. So we were all running around in little circles and making fools of ourselves because we thought you were coming to us for money. And that may in the end be what you do. There should be a partnership there. But a lot of politicians, particularly mayors, will say, great idea. Then when it comes to an election year like next year and you've got to raise your property taxes, it's not such a great idea. So I think you're going to have to really concentrate on the feds. And the province and the municipal politicians are going to have a hard time with this. I think you should come to Mississauga Council and do it exactly the way you did it today. That was brilliant. You did a really good job. I'm concerned about the cargo, obviously, because when we were driving here today, the backup to make the exit on Dixie was, I would guess, almost all the way to where we are today. It's going to take half an hour for people to get off the highway there. So I know if you bring in more rapid transit and get some of the cars off the road, you've got more room for trucks. I don't know what you do. And you've got David Collinette working on a rail program. The guy lives trains. He's amazing. I can remember when I was an MP, Hazel asked us for the BRT for funding. And Collinette looked at it and he says, but it doesn't go to the airport. And he said, we're not funding that. And we didn't. And then the Tories came along and they funded it, and it still doesn't go to the airport. So that makes absolutely no sense to me. I drive by it all the time. There's like one passenger, and I think it's cardboard on those buses. You just don't see a lot of people in that busway because it's, where's it going to? Renfrew. And it's taking people right through all the neighborhoods that have four-car garages. So I don't get it. But I hope with that addition, it's going to make a big difference. I think the jobs are obviously good quality jobs, and they need to stay at the airport, and they need to be employing my Malton people. So I thank you very much. I really sincerely hope you'll come and do a presentation at council, and keep in mind that you have to soothe their fevered brows at the beginning by saying, we're not here to ask you for money today.
Got it.
But thank you. That was really good, Hillary. Oh, and thank you for Denville Park, even though we've messed up on announcements on that. I'm sorry about that. It's still messed up. It's still on our website. I took it off mine, but it's on everybody else's. But it's a thing to celebrate. That is a really unique thing that you've done there. Oh, tell the room. It's the highest spot in Mississauga, Denville Park, and the airport put $300,000 into putting a viewing station up there. And they had a public contest. They ought to name it and to do the designs. It's in my word, and it's very incredible. It's just amazing. So I thank you very much. I thank you for, it's Danville Park, named after Danny Singh. He thinks it's named after him. It's actually named after the street.
Where's Danville Park?
Danville Park is just, where is it, Danny? Courtney Park, yes. And 410, yeah. And it's a lovely, I don't know when we're opening it, but it's beautiful. Okay, well, we'll be there with bells on, and I thank you for that. And I also thank you for the small donations for things. We're building a Castles playground in Malton, right beside the arena. You've been involved in that. You've been involved in renaming the arena after Paul Coffey, which really gave a lot of excitement to Malton. Malton's a great little village. Having a ball, and you guys are being terrific, so I thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for that input and feedback. We'll absolutely come to council and talk about our transit vision, and you know, this transit center, I believe sits in Malton. And the opportunity, so when we looked at international airports that have already gone on this journey to become multimodal hubs, Amsterdam Schiphol is a great example of a community that has been completely changed as a result of the transit connectivity there. And they, as a result of this connectivity, have the highest commercial land values in the country. That's amazing. Imagine the potential for Malton.
Well, the other thing, too, is when I was an MP, I was our NATO rep until I called the Americans a bad name. And and I did tons of travel, and I hate shopping. I never go to Square One. So I used to do all my shopping because I was bored at the airport. So that 30% that you're earning there makes perfect sense to me. I contributed to that over 13 years.
Yeah.
Great. Stephen.
Yeah, I'd just like to, again, thank Robin and Hillary for some very interesting and very focused presentations today. Just on the transit hub document, and when I read this document, it was sent out earlier this week, it does read in some ways as a very effective lobbying document. It's very focused, lays out the idea that you can't have you can't have passenger expansion unless you're going to get funding for extra security clearance and border security. And that's what you're asking for clearly in the document and the recommendations. But I really don't want to see what I think it's a little bit lost is that when we talk about a mobility hub, yes, you're moving people through the airport from international, domestic scales. But we can no longer think of airports as places where just people move through and work. I mean, they are parts of the community where people live, and about what do you do with that last mile problem? What kind of services are you going to have around the airport for workers and for people? Are you going to have grocery stores? Are you going to have fitness clubs? Are you going to have daycare, which we've talked about before, for workers? And I think that's something that I hate to get lost. And I guess my question for you, and I don't know the answer to this, but since I've now lived in Toronto for off and on for now going on 20 years, transit politics are our politics.
Oh, sure.
It defines everything. There's in the U.S., it's residential segregation, but in Toronto, it's transit politics. And how are you ever going to – knowing what John Tory's done, knowing he's in deep for Scarborough Subway, that's already increasing to $3.5, maybe $4 billion, how are you going to make this case to get him undug from that – the eastern side of the city, and move some of that investment to the west.
Or the north.
Or the northwest, yeah.
We've spent the last 2 years talking about this transit vision, and I feel that it probably takes 2 years to make the case for important infrastructure, large infrastructure, and to start to see stakeholder alignment against it. So, and maybe that's fast, maybe that's slow. I don't know. Lena would certainly have an opinion about that based on everything you folks have been working on. But to be at the stage now where, you know, we can have meetings with Mayor Tory or Mayor Crombie and maybe their say and their do don't necessarily line up, but this is something that Mayor Tory wasn't talking about 2 years ago, that Stephen Del Duca, Minister Del Duca, wasn't talking about necessarily 2 years ago, although they did, you know, bring us our first important chapter, which is the UP Express. So we're really happy to start to create the momentum behind this initiative. And right up to the federal level, understanding of how important this region is, how impactful congestion is, and then the need for everyone to think about integrated transit networks. So not just transit lines that go to nowhere, but transit lines that connect employment and residential zones. There's great alignment here. And so we're trying to capitalize on this alignment right now and to absolutely get more engagement from the province and the federal government, especially as these pools of funds are available, including the federal fund, I think it's $11 billion for trade enabling infrastructure. Well, this is trade enabling infrastructure right through to the transit component.
I would think that it would be, especially for the federal government, more politically appealing to shift transit resources to a central hub like the airport, where it's got an international function, a regional function, as opposed to a specific local function like the Scarborough transit line would have. Like, I mean, I think the city wants to balance it for all wards, but when it comes to federal dollars, they want what's going to get as much bank, like return on investment, because this is where the jobs are, and just politically to affect as many people as possible.
I think you're right, Shane. The shovel ready, shovel worthy, and trade enabling is sort of the language that Minister Sohi has used at the federal level. And so we like to go in and say check.
Correlation
check,
of votes.
Check.
Like, yeah.
I just want to pick up on the last mile comment that you made, Stephen. It is something that we're looking at as well, because the last mile is defined as, you know, somebody, how you get from someone's home to transit, and then how you get from the end of your transit line to the place that you work. And in a downtown Toronto setting, that's a little easier when it's much more densely situated, where we're much more spread out here. Something we've been talking to Ryerson about, they're looking at doing some work with us to try and understand that last mile, and it's probably a combination of things, conventional transit options, but maybe some new, more disruptive types of options and non-traditional type of transit. And part of that is changing your landscape and your land use. The airport corporate center, one of the challenges they say they have is, you know, there isn't a gym, there isn't a great place to go walking, there's nowhere to meet my colleague for a beer after work. So that doesn't exist. When they can't get workers to come out here, they're running private shuttles. So transit has an ability to try to solve the problem in terms of getting workers there, but then also help to change that sense of place. And so the concept of a transit center as well starts to impact the land form around as well. So you try and create that livable work
Absolutely.
Area, right?
No, I agree with that 100%. And even for business travelers, what have you. I mean, the fact that you have the Keg, Hooters, and strip bars, that's amenities for 1950s, not 20 to 20.
And you don't want to walk from one to the other at night.
No,
Let's go.
Sorry.
Laurie, at the last meeting we talked a little bit about doing a study to find out the demographics of the labor living around or working around the airport, and particularly north of Steele and Brampton. Did we get any information from through Brampton Board of Trade or City of Brampton?
We haven't. I mean, I don't know whether our study is going to pick up in terms of the employees here and where they live and go a bit further.
I think as part of the work separately that we're doing on the community investment program, and I think a big piece of the first phase that we need to do is also to better understand the demographics of the neighborhoods around the airport, so that these things will all intersect, which is great. But maybe.
Yeah. All right.
Any questions for Hillary?
I just got one. So, did I hear you say that you weren't looking for funding for the new terminal setup that you were going to, the bus or the transit terminal? Did you just say that?
Now, if you take a look at this structure.
Right. Because that's going to be a new terminal, right?
It's a new terminal. And at this stage, we built out our capital funding requirements, and that is one that we can fund from our own means.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, is the growth that you've projected, and I've seen a lot of things over the last couple of years at the GTAA.
Okay.
If this thing does not happen,
yeah.
Does that mean the growth does not happen for the GTAA? Is it all tied together as one big package? For you to become in 2035 to get to 70 million passengers a year, do you need to have this new terminal? Like if this is a must have, is it a nice to have? That's what I'm trying to say.
Well, again, if you go back to the types of the type of growth we're experiencing, which is international. So with international destinations and routes come the wide bodies. And so as we need more space for the wide bodies, which carry more passengers, we know that, you know, assuming the forecasts are right, and we do low case scenarios and high case scenarios, and we try to come out at the midpoint, experiencing very healthy growth. There was a time when we thought we wouldn't hit 50 million passengers till beyond 2020. Well, it's coming faster than we thought. We think we'll hit that before 2020 now. So the growth is incredible. our responsibility is to try to forecast out, understand what's coming, and then adapt our operations to accommodate that. And we think that one of the ways to accommodate that growth is to have this type of processing center with a ground transportation center.
One other thing, did you say KPMG did a study in Copenhagen as well for an airport? Did you?
Yeah, I said that.
Is that public?
I don't know. I actually don't know.
We did a study on international examples of multimodal hubs, which we can send you a link to. We can send everyone
a
link
to
it.
Just to have an idea of what other places look like. Because I think what you're doing is fantastic. Okay, so great presentation, both of you ladies. Fantastic, so appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Any other questions? Any from our technical team members? Everyone smiling back there? Still awake? Okay, so that moves us on to our next piece of agenda. Thank you very much, Hillary and Robin, for joining us tonight and for great presentations. We are moving into item number 4, which is our member update. And I am going to start to my right, Councillor Parrish. Anything to update us on? Okay.
Thank you.
Savick, anything from the college?
Yeah, a couple of things. I'll just at Seneca, we have a School of Aviation with a diploma and a flight program, which is a degree program, and it's the biggest group ever. We have 300 students in the diploma program and about 200 in the flight program, and it's incredibly busy. We have we're looking at adding a couple of new programs in a couple of years. We're building some new facilities at Newnham with Finch and 404, and looking at airport management and quality management in aviation as well. So it's one of those things. We work with the GTAA to get some, they've been very supportive in some of the things, meetings that we've had. So I really do appreciate that. I'm really looking forward to seeing that demographic study and what the needs are for the future. But thank you very much.
Star from Brampton Board of Trade.
Sure, yeah. I can update you on a couple of things. I think in tandem with us positioning which is a perfect fit from a strategic visioning perspective. The chambers, as well as related business stakeholders, also continue to take a look at this whole globalization process, not just as an individual piece, but as a regional piece. So Brampton Board of Trade was invited by World Trade Center Toronto, or Toronto Board of Trade, I guess they're part and parcel of each other, to join them for a joint trade mission. To UAE and explore some healthcare-related opportunities there. It's the first time ever in my 10 years of Brampton Board of Trade that I've seen us two collaborating in such a manner. From the Brampton side, the political lead was for the whole delegation was actually Mayor Lynn Jeffrey. And from our side, in addition to City Suffering being represented by Sandra Beckett from Economic Development, myself, I represented directors, Todd Lutz, our CEO, joined the delegation along with the head of research for Bill Monster, the dean for medical sciences for Sheridan College, along with a number of individual businesses. The interaction with the UAE stakeholders was phenomenal, from meeting our own assets on the ground, i.e. Canadian High Commissioner, Council General in UAE, as well. We also got to meet the Ministry of Economic Development for Dubai. They gave us a full briefing in terms of what to do and what not to do, or what to avoid in UAE or in Dubai in particular. We got to visit local hospitals, got to experience the differences or see the differences between our model of funding healthcare versus their privately funded healthcare models. Depending on insurance you can afford. You can have a regular room to a deluxe room to a really luxurious room. the best part of it was interacting with the stakeholders that came from around the world to attend this expo called 40,000 stakeholders from around the world attended 7 years. I believe the second largest healthcare related expo now.
We had an opportunity to not just position Brampton as a place to come set up a business, but also position the region from that perspective. I extended my trip after the mayor and and spent another week and a half in Pakistan. I hadn't been to Pakistan in about 6 years. For those of you who might not know, I'm originally from Pakistan. So this newly found love of mine for the Chamber of Movements was utilized to its full extent. I got a meeting with the CEO of Trade Development of Pakistan, the chair of the Federations of Chambers of Commerce of Pakistan, which represents 64 chambers across the country. They are bringing a delegation of about 200 businesses to our neck of the woods in July. Pakistan does continue to struggle with the political landscape at home. There are aggressive forces that are trying to basically hold the country back. But at the business community level, I found a lot of drive and a lot of interest in working with Canadians. And here's the interesting part. The CEO for Trade Development Authority Pakistan, whose job is to give direction to Pakistani exports, is a dual nationality holder. The immediate past president for Lahore Chamber of Commerce. Lahore is a city I'm from, second largest city in Pakistan, 20,000 members. The gentleman runs a plastic extrusion business, very well integrated in the local automotive sector. Also a dual nationality holder with Canada. So I think we have some great resources on the ground that we can leverage. The conversations with the trade commissioner there went pretty well too. And again, in addition to positioning Brampton, and we'll continue to build on that collaborative approach. I was tired, but it was good. Now, and while I was there, we signed, European Union ratified our free trade agreement. So I had to take a 2-day stay in Brussels on the way back, which was also fabulous. So looking forward to actually taking a joint delegation to Brussels down the road.
Yes, I just continue to work with the All Workers Council. We were fortunate enough a few weeks ago to get some play on the CBC. Some of you heard those interviews and those stories. It was quite good. They did a full off-air podcast that they broadcasted on the life of a security worker here at the airport. And then they had me followed up. That was the issue that they initially said, and I was prepping and being pre-interviewed for. But the CBC reporter framed the issue and flipped it back to the working conditions. Even though because the links are very strong, you're a poor worker, you can't afford a car, you're stuck on public transit for 2 hours after. That still get phone calls, so they do want to do a follow up story at some point. Maybe they'll get the chance at that time.
Thank you, Dan.
It just makes sense what to try and do here because you're right. The concept of working at the airport in the city of Toronto without a car makes no sense unless you're.
Thank you for taking that challenge on. I think it was podcasted, so it's a very good
it's in the link.
Yeah. I'd like to watch that.
Matt Galloway.
Great. Thanks for having me here. I'd also like to point out one thing that's happening at Brampton tomorrow morning, which is the Transportation Challenge. I know you get wrapped up in your international travels there, Badar, but I thought I would mention that, something local that's happening in Brampton. So congratulations to the Brampton Board of Trade for bringing that forward. One of the things that that we've been asking about at the city and with Commissioner Jeff Wright is an express bus to the airport that goes from Square One. We believe there's a lot of people that are working in the, or living around that area that do need transportation to the airport. I understand there is a bus now, the 107, that takes 28 minutes to get from Square One to the airport. And anyone who's driven from the Square One to the airport knows that it doesn't take 28 minutes. So somewhere along the way, it's stopping. We'd like to see a, an express bus, a nonstop bus that would go from Square One to the airport. I understand from Commissioner Wright that there is a new bus that will be traveling along the BRT that will be starting at Winston Churchill and running right along the BRT, stopping at Square One and then continuing on to the airport. So we'll continue to work with the Commissioner to get something that's really more of a direct line. One of the things that we're involved with, along with our friends in the Brampton Board of Trade, is the Canada Innovation Corridor, which is focused on goods movement in the area. We talk about people movement, but then someone mentioned, Councillor Parrish mentioned about trying to turn from Dixie Road and the trucks that are on there. So there are seven chambers involved with this project, the Canada Innovation Corridor, running from Toronto to Kitchener-Waterloo, and goods movement is something that we are studying to see what recommendations we can make in order to relieve that. And of course, the transportation hub working with GTAA is certainly a big part of that. We did host Minister Del Duca today with the kind sponsorship of the Greater Toronto Airports Authority. So once again, Lori, Hillary's gone. Okay, Lori, you can take the thanks to Hillary then. And one of the things that we do continue to press the minister on through the Ontario Chamber of Commerce and directly is regional transit. It's something that we really have to have. We understand the TTC is softening a bit now. They seem to be the holdout in making this thing really happen. But we need to keep that pressure on until that actually happens. And then we know that we won't have this political battle when it comes to funding and who's going to pay for what. So we continue to work on that. And finally, for all of your questions around the political arena, we do have our politicians' reception coming up in April, and we look forward to Councillor Parrish being there, and she can field all the questions about transit and transportation in the city of Mississauga.
She's officially an expert.
But we do look forward to having we've checked out the schedules for the MPs, the MPPs. We know that everyone is, no one's sitting at the Ontario Legislature, no one's sitting in Ottawa. We check to make sure that no one has any retreats or other events planned within their parties. So we expect to have a really good showing of MPs, MPPs, city councillors, trustees. We hope the mayor will join us as well, and of course any of our other friends that would like to join from any of the legislatures. And that is it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
David, what's the actual date in April? We'll compare our minutes.
The actual date is, I'm going to say it's April the 17th. Let me check on that,
okay.
And I will confirm that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Heather, welcome. I'm sorry
yes.
that you missed some of the presentations, but it's great to see you.
Yes, and so I extend my regrets for my apologies for my tardiness, but I was, in fact, it relates to my point I'm about to talk about, and that I was in a meeting that's related to the Ontario government's review of the Travel Industry Act. So I was just going right from that meeting into, so I did mention it last last meeting I had attended. The government is now in phase two of that review, and with a deadline of April the 13th for any feedback and submissions. The government is right now conducting consultations with stakeholders as well as consumers. Just to let you know that this act that we're all bound by in the province is wide open. So in that, you know, there shouldn't even be an act. Maybe there shouldn't be any compensation fund. A lot of things that are just on a full review, hadn't been done since its inception, so probably outside of Band-Aid amendments, talking 30 years, so it's well overdue. And
has ACTA taken a position or put in a submission that you could share?
So we shared our we submitted for the first phase. The second phase ends April the 14th. ACTA is attending all. I think I've probably been to part of at least a half a dozen consultations, both with TICO, the Travel Industry Council of Ontario, the Ontario government, our own member consultation, various large, small member meetings, and we're conducting a survey. In the end, we will try as best to present a common denominator, a position of some sort, because it's opinions depending on your type of model, corporate, leisure. There's a lot of variants of opinions. So, ultimately, have to go to government in with how this is going to impact the consumer. So that's underway, and then phase three will immediately start with hopefully recommendations coming through the government by fall. So that's the big thing that's happening right now.
Sounds like it's taking a lot of your time.
Yeah.
Question?
Madam Chair, to confirm that date, I was off by one day. It's on April the 18th at the Mississauga Grand Convention Center.
All right, we'll put that in our minutes. Anton, any updates from you? Hello, is it on?
Okay. All right. Well, this is a delightful presentation to go through all these fantastic numbers which we were exposed to. But I see three headwinds which are blowing in here, and I'm sure your people who are analyzing the data would have found it. The first thing is that the demand for aircrafts are not for the large-bodied aircrafts anymore. The demand for the aircrafts are for the single-aisle aircrafts. So all the growth is going to come from China and India and all for the Airbus, A320s, the NEOs, which necessarily are not coming here. So they're doing the shuttles inside. That's number one. And the second part is, Samik, you got your job cut out because there's going to be a massive pilot shortage. Right? A lot of people are retiring and there's a huge pilot shortage. Our own Canadian company, CAE, has become now a trainer of getting more pilots so that we have them flying in. And the third one is touches to Stephen's interview. This is one industry where the rankers really go up. They can go up, right? They start at that entry level, and after a couple of years, they are really going up. But you see, there's a massive labor turnover at that front line, right? So if that happens, that the demand for the workforce demand, which PSN requires, will get wiped out because there is nobody coming up the ranks because they are leaving the job at the front line. So I just thought I'll leave it out there.
No, so good point. So I think you're right. One of the worries, in large part why we're doing this labor study, it's in part to understand what is today so we can plan for tomorrow. I've heard that comment made about pilots before, not coming out of this study necessarily, but from other airports and even from officials at Transport Canada. They're sort of worried about, you know, what is the plan and where are all these pilots going to come from? And so understanding and being ready for that is important. Your first point, I wouldn't mind us going back and understanding. So what you're seeing is that aircraft demand is for smaller aircraft?
Yes. The study is coming out. I think I circulated it about 2-3 meetings ago. The Airbus study and the Boeing study, which came out about the future demand for the next 20 years, 96% of their demand is single-aisle aircrafts. The A320s, the NEOs, kind of stuff. So, and that is because countries like India and countries like China, they're having massive internal growth happening domestically, right? So we see passenger number, we see data. This is the problem with big data. Be careful of big data because what you see is not what you get, right? So we see this massive growth of aircrafts happening. When you drill down, it's not big aircrafts. And Pearson takes care of the bigger wide-bodied aircrafts. A380, which was the bigger aircraft everybody invested in, there's no demand for it anymore. Some of them are not even taking delivery of the A380s anymore. So we'll have infrastructure stuck here because you all invested heavily on the A380 and with the multiple ramps and all, and it won't come here after another 10 years time. So I'm just leaving it out there.
Well, it's something we probably our planners look at, because I appreciate, you know, as emerging markets grow and their demand for more air travel and propensity to travel, and so that sort of uplift and requirement from a small aircraft. Because what we're seeing is our average aircraft size is going up here. But we also know that as passenger traffic is growing with that average aircraft size going up, we're seeing that, you know, that 6-7% in passenger growth is a, you know, 2% growth in aircraft movements.
Anton, just a couple of things here. I will send a link to the Boeing and Airbus market assessment. They do it every year. And I have to say the Boeing assessment is fantastic. It tells you where it's growing, how it's growing, why it's growing. A simple thing that you saw on the slide here today with the GTAA, the GDP growth is the big driver of airport growth. The economics numbers are huge. And India and China, their GDP growth dwarfs everything else in the world, and hence the travel and the money that people have to spend. But I think they do it every year. The report is excellent, and it really is. It's good reading if you're an airplane buff, and I am. And but you got to really stay on top of it. And Toronto is very unique, as I think we've always said, it's an international airport and it's a mega hub. So what you see, you can't take a global perspective of Boeing and Airbus. You have to be very specific to you gotta look at the specifics of Toronto and specific of this particular growth. But, you know, pilot shortages and things like that, people will come here. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, so actually it's probably a good thing for us to put in our work plan, and so we'll put it in the survey. We are updating our own forecast right now, and I know our forecasting folks look at, you know, well, what are the aircraft manufacturers saying? So what's Boeing and Airbus saying? Look at that data.
Boeing has the best data set of any company because they've had it for 100 years, and they do these 20-year projections. And they every time they analyze what happened the previous 5 years or 10 years, they usually go past whatever the assessments are. And you look at it takes into account the financial as well as and every particular region and country. It is incredibly detailed. And it's available right on the Boeing website. But I'll send it to you guys.
That'd be great. We'll circulate it.
And you can
pass
it along.
And if the folks are ready with the forecast, maybe that's something we can put on our May agenda. We'll have to see. Great. Thank you. Lena.
Thank you.
Councillor Dillon, welcome.
Okay.
I'm sorry you missed all of our presentations. But we're so excited for you to be here. So thank you. Anything from council that you want to update us on? And Eric, anything from the region of Peel?
A couple of things. Well, my first time here, so I hope my update is written the appropriate. So we are doing a growth management exercise working with the Saga, Brampton, and Carleton, looking at where the what I saw in the presentation, it didn't surprise me because it is happening throughout the whole region. So we are growing. We know that we are growing. And I'm from transportation. So we are doing a transportation master plan to respond to that growth. multimodal, not only transit, but all modes of transport. We talk about last mile, how we treat last mile is through cycling, shared mobility, nowadays we have this Uber phenomenon happening. We also have a component to talk about goods movement. Investing in looking at efficiencies of how do we move goods. Working with the Board of Trade, working with different stakeholders, private companies. One of the specific things around the airport, we're still in draft, we're still consulting, but a potential recommendation is looking at off-peak delivery, spreading the demand of trucks going to the off-peak, not competing with the commuters. We'll call it a pilot, we'll see how it goes. We have some lessons learned from 2 years ago in the Pan Am Games, where Toronto has done some of the pilots. And to prepare for that, we also installed some of the permanent count stations, some of them near the airport area, so that we can understand the full profile, 24 hours, how the truck movement are happening, analytics and all that. That's something very exciting happening, and we are working together, this master plan, also with the Mississauga's master plan is also happening right now. Metrolink's also updating their master plan. The Ministry of Transportation also looking on a very broad master plan, very long term. Also looking with the staff, looking with Jinko as well. We are working together, coordinating our plan.
Right. That's excellent. Thank you. Others aren't aware of this. Peel Region is one of two municipalities or governments or whatever. Texas, I think, is the only other place where there's a goods movement strategy that's been put in place. Texas and Peel. So really commended for taking the lead. I mean, you've been out there on this goods movement strategy for a couple of years now, and so we've been happy to participate. But you really see this year there's a real focus of attention by a lot of others who are jumping on your bandwagon, which is, means you're doing something right, through some work that this Innovation Corridor group is doing, focusing on goods movement. So congratulations on that. And I think with the province now coming with their integrated transportation strategy, that was one of my other ideas. I didn't know if maybe we should ask the province to come and share with us what this integrated transportation they're working on, Tia Dirks. We'll become transit experts for sure. Just a couple things before I wrap up. We've got 4 minutes to go, and I promise to get us out of here on time. We are working on the airport master plan. So this is our technical, what we're building plan that looks at sort of in the building, the air side, terminal, roadside. And so that's a document that is being worked on this year. We focused a lot last year on the transit piece. We're focusing this year more on roads and goods movement and other pieces of that. We are watching very closely a bill that's going through federal parliament right now. So the preclearance agreement between Canada and the United States, the U.S. did get through, the agreement was renegotiated. It needs to be actually enacted through legislation to be effective. Fortunately, it went through the United States during what they call the lame duck period, so before, after the election and before President Trump was sworn in, and so they had theirs through. The Canadian piece of legislation is moving into second reading, so we're highly supportive of this. I mean, preclearance in Toronto is a big factor in us maintaining ourselves as a global hub, moving to the mega hub status, so really critical for us. And then the last one, I don't know if anyone noticed, maybe look on your way out. There's some new electric vehicle charging stations that are sitting at the edge of our parking lot, kind of bagged up and ready to go. So this is a partnership with the province with some funding, TRCA, through Partners in Project Green. So we have 32 new charging stations that will be operational starting the beginning of April. They're free to the public. They're here and a couple of other locations around the airport. So, we're hoping to do a big sort of public launch communication with the minister and TRCA sometime. But that's another sort of exciting thing that we're doing in terms of doing our part. And that's a big part of us hitting our own targets around GHG. So I want to make sure I go around the room. Harold, anything from economic development in the city? Press it again.
That's great. Okay. Just really quickly, since I've heard the term transportation master plan uttered, we are undertaking the same in the city of Mississauga. I'm hoping everyone's coordinated and working together because that's important. As it relates to the airport specifically, just two quick comments. First, really enjoyed growing our relationship with Route Development Group. It continues to evolve every week in terms of different markets, and it's great that we can collaborate on that. Mississauga Economic Development and the airport staff and work cooperatively on business development opportunities. And the third point I'd like to bring up, because I haven't been here in a while, is some of you may or may not be aware that back in July of 2016, Mississauga hosted the Japan Festival. And what was unusual about that is that this festival is an annual event and it rotates. And it has been met with mediocre success in Canada over the last decade or so. But last July, we had a one-day event at Celebration Square, and thanks to the many Japanese companies that call Mississauga home, nearly 100, the event surpassed 40,000 visitors in one day, making it the largest Japanese festival ever in Canada. And so, of course, a number of organizations, including the embassy and the Japanese government, have taken notice of this, and they're hoping to have another Japanese festival in 2017 in July, and they're beginning to ramp this up. It's taking more of a political turn. It's going to be two to three days, maybe a week-long affair, and they're hoping to achieve 80,000 guests, which would make it the largest Japanese festival in all of North America. And this time all around, they'll be inviting many cultural guests from Japan to provide various things for people, to cultural experiences for people, young and old, to be involved in. So the reason I'm telling you that, in terms of their connectivity, a lot of the companies that have sponsored and have agreed to sponsor and are lining up this year, to my surprise, to sponsor this one, are long-standing companies that are very reliant on the airport. And so I'd like to share this, and I'm sure you'll hear more about it in the future, but just speaking to the globalization and the intensity of international connections as it relates to the airport and the airport region, I think this is a really good speaking point. Thank you.
Thank you. Just quickly, over the last few months, the City of Brampton Economic Development Office has been restructured. We have a new director in place, Bob Darling. We have some new senior managers in place. We're taking a sector-specific approach to our industries in Brampton. And I'd be happy to provide more information once we get a bit more time under our belt, but for now, I just wanted to provide that update. Thank you.
Second, anything from the province? So you heard me say maybe it'd be a good idea to get a presentation on the integrated transportation plan. Is that the name of it?
It's the GGH, the
Greater Golden Horseshoe. Okay,
transportation. I will talk to the project manager and see if I happen to see her.
Okay. Other updates from you from the province?
Specifically, we're still, I think I mentioned, I was talking to Hillary earlier about we continue to work on the inner city bus file. Part of the mandate of the Premier and Minister was to modernize the inner city bus industry. So we're hopeful one way or the other we'll have an announcement. Modernization, the other word for it is deregulation, so that could change or shake up the whole industry in terms of there'll be no market entry controls, so it'll be similar to what's occurred in Manitoba and Alberta, where, and like the airline deregulation, if you're fit, willing, and able, and you meet the insurance and safety requirements, then you can enter the market. So, in terms of your transit hub, that may be. Smaller vehicles, so you see in the States, where less than 10 passengers, where you have a lot of vans and things like
around it. Certainly, you know, might help the road congestion if we can get more people into those type of vehicles traveling out to the airport. So,
the last month, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah, and so
I
guess we're hopeful there'll be some announcement as part of the budgetary process coming up.
When's the budget?
We don't have a date, but we usually...
Nice try.
Nice try.
Nice try.
That's what we thought I'd ask.
When's the budget and what's in it? Would have been better.
We're not recording anything you say.
It's being recorded.
You all know better.
But I mean...
Very good.
I think if the federal government announces, we usually tend to follow the federal government.
Soon. Matthew, anything from Ontario Tourism?
So I'll be quick because I know we're past six, but it's shaping up likely to be an exciting year for tourism. It's 2017, so Ontario 150, Canada 150, which obviously for not only Canada but for the province as well. So supporting a lot of that work, the ministry at the end of November released its what we call the strategic framework. So it's just, you know, government speak for our sort of our guiding document for what we're going to be doing over the next so many. A lot of it's working with the industry to ensure that the ministry and the government is helping the tourism industry grow. How can it function well and people make money and that sort of thing. A big piece out of the framework is that we're working closely with the Ministry of Economic Development and Growth to include tourism as part of the province's red tape challenge. This is the Open for Business group in government that's looking at how to either reduce or modernize regulations so businesses can getting rid of unnecessary regulations or modernizing ones that are quite old. So tourism is a part of that. Tourism, as you know, is a big industry that encompasses very many different industries. So, but the point of it is how can we help the tourism industry grow in the province, and that's a big piece for us. So. So big year for us. I'll at the next few meetings, I'll update you as the year moves along, but we're looking forward to it.
And I guess tourism last year was across the country very positive.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if you have any sort of final numbers for Ontario.
So the data is a challenging piece. Like the Stats Can obviously does most of the national work, and then we take a subset of that at the provincial level. We're right now working, there's entry numbers that show 2016 was a great year, but we're actually working off of 2014 confirmed numbers. So one of the pushes as part of the strategic framework is to ensure that we can get more up-to-date data, because the industry relies on the government to provide reliable data to make business decisions. We've seen, you know, double digit increases from the international market, from the U.S. market. Part of that, of course, is the exchange rate. So one of the things we're looking at with the industry is how can we ensure that the industry continues to do well regardless of, currency fluctuations, especially as it relates to Americans. Not to get political, but given the political climate in the United States, there's also an opportunity for Canada to benefit from increased international tourism, because people may decide not to travel to our neighbors to the south for political reasons. So there's opportunities for Canada there as well. So.
Okay, so we're a couple minutes after six, but not too bad. Any final words before I call for a motion to adjourn? None? A motion to adjourn? Star, seconded by Heather. All those in favor? Any opposed? I always know why I ask that. Thanks very much. Great meeting. See everybody in May.